started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we know that there are a lot of listeners who wish to know that if witnesses during a marriage contract are necessary, can a man and a woman recite the formula, the marriage formula or the marriage contract in private without the presence of any witnesses? And is it also compulsory or necessary for a resident religious scholar to be present there to recite the contract formula, the marriage contract formula?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, many people, for example, in the Indian subcontinent, are under the impression that the nikah or the marriage formula should be recited by a local alim or by an alim and a scholar, a religious cleric, and he should initiate the nikah for them. This is their understanding of nikah, and they think that it's not possible, not permissible, for them to recite the formula of nikah by themselves in private. That is actually a misconception. I believe the Shia Muslims who are living in these countries and predominantly Sunni countries are under the impression, under the Sunni influence, because according to the Sunni jurisprudence, it is necessary that there be witnesses present. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Unlike the Shia school of jurisprudence, which maintains that there is no need for any witnesses when the nikah is contracted or concluded. Mm-hmm. Okay, the Sunnis believe that there is the presence of witnesses is a must, and there should be two people to witness the conclusion of the nikah or the contract of the nikah.
Mm-hmm.
So the Shia Muslims, I think, need to improve their knowledge and understanding of the Shia fiqh, the Shia jurisprudence, and the Shia Islamic laws, so as not to end up making a mistake in matters of prayer, fasting, and also Hajj and Nikah. These are the important issues which are of daily significance, and mm-hmm. and they are very much relevant to our daily life. Then to sum up, to put it in a nutshell, I would say that there is no need for any witnesses, and of course the man and the woman can recite the Nikah without any witnesses, and they can recite it by themselves, mm-hmm. provided that other conditions are met, okay?
Oh, what do you mean? What are other conditions?
Other conditions, of course, if a girl is virgin, if a girl is dependent in the matters of her life, she should obtain her father's permission, uh-huh. or her paternal father's paternal grandfather's permission.
Mm-hmm.
And without his permission, the marriage is going to be invalid.
Yes.
Okay. A girl, a virgin girl or a dependent girl. Okay.
Yes.
A girl is dependent when her father has a say in her marriage.
Mm-hmm.
A girl is dependent when her father...
Even if she's not virgin?
Even if she's not virgin. Even if a girl, for example, has committed adultery, or let's say she has had sexual intercourse with another man,
right,
without nikah,
mm-hmm,
she's still treated as virgin in the eye of Islamic Sharia.
Uh-huh.
She is virgin because she has never been married lawfully in the past. Though she has lost her hymen, and she's no longer virgin medically speaking. Okay,
right.
But from the viewpoint of Sharia, she is still regarded as virgin, and therefore she needs her father's permission when she wants to get married to someone.
And is it necessary to ask a resident alim, a religious scholar, to say or pronounce the nikah formula?
No, I'm trying to say and to underscore the fact that there's no need for a resident alim or for a scholar to pronounce the nikah. Okay, they can do it, and they can recite the nikah themselves. After the woman, okay, gets her father's permission.
As long as they can make sure of the correct pronunciation of the marriage formula, right?
It's not a big deal in the sense that it's very easy to pronounce it.
Yes.
It's very important, first of all, that the two parties to the marriage should initiate the nikah. And their intention of reciting, for example, Zawajtu or Qabiltu, okay?
Yes.
These words which are uttered by the two parties, they should recite it in Arabic first of all, and then the intention is should be to initiate the relationship. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of only reciting, pronouncing the nikah and having no intention. The intention is
important.
An essential part of the nikah.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
And you also mentioned that it should be pronounced in Arabic.
Of course.
So it can't be pronounced in other languages.
You know, Arabic is necessary if the two parties can recite it in Arabic, okay?
Uh-huh.
As I said, it's not very difficult to recite the Arabic formula. It's very easy, and you can learn it in a matter of 1 or 2 minutes. You can read it from the paper, and you can read it. If you cannot read from the paper, you can read the transliteration.
Yes.
The transliteration. And of course, if none of this is possible and the two parties feel they cannot recite it correctly, they can recite the formula in their own language, provided that it gives the same meaning. And
under the same intention.
And it's coupled with the same intention, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning should be the same. The intention should be the same.
And is there any difference between permanent and temporary marriages here?
It doesn't make any difference. Both of them can be recited in Arabic, and also in case of inability, they can recite it in their own language, provided that it should have the same structure and the same meaning and should give the same meaning.
Sheikh Javed, you know, since we are talking about matrimony, is it possible or is it permissible for a husband, actually a man, to see and talk to his fiancée?
Well, you know, it depends from one situation to another, okay?
Right.
If a man wants to see his fiancée in the presence of her parents or in a gathering of family members, there's no problem, okay?
Yes.
They can see each other, they can talk to each other, but generally this does not happen, and the two sides want to see each other in private, they want to speak with each other in private, and that is not permissible, because it's very much likely that they might end up falling into a sin. A fiancé is a woman, a would-be wife, okay? A would-be wife who is expected to be the man's wife, the man's wife in the near future, but they have not concluded the nikah, the marriage contract,
mm-hmm.
and so therefore they are non-mahram to each other. As long as they are non-mahram to each other, they cannot treat each other as husband and wife. They cannot consider each other as husband and wife, and they cannot, of course, deal with each other in the same context, and they cannot do what a normal husband and wife do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not permissible for them to express love, to joke with each other, to look at each other with lustful intention, to have physical contact. All of these are forbidden.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
Donald Trump is planning an early morning send-off event for himself at a military airfield in Maryland on Wednesday, 20th of January, several hours before his successor, Joe Biden, is inaugurated as the 46th U.S. president at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Joanna Walters and Martin Bellum. The piece is titled Trump to hold early morning send-off ceremony on Biden inauguration day. Stay with us for more of Joanna Walters and Martin Bellum's article. Donald Trump is planning an early morning send-off event for himself at a military airfield in Maryland on Wednesday, just several hours before his successor, Joe Biden, is inaugurated as the 46th U.S. president at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. For his last presidential ceremony, Donald Trump reportedly wants an ostentatious military parade and an official armed forces farewell as the commander-in-chief, as well as a large crowd of supporters, selected backers, and current and former officials in his administration and their guests at a huge red carpet event. But latest reports indicate that Trump, who is facing an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate and a number of criminal and civil investigations, will not be afforded a big military send-off, just 2 weeks after a deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building that followed his exhorting of his supporters to fight to overturn the election result. Invitations have been issued from the White House for an event taking place at Joint Base Andrews, the military base in Maryland used by Air Force One, at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, 20th of January, just 4 hours before Joe Biden will take his oath. Many details of the ceremony are not yet clear, although attendees will have to make a pre-dawn start and have been told to arrive by 7:15 a.m. at the latest, when temperatures are forecast to be below freezing. Attendees may not bring items including firearms, ammunition, explosives, laser pointers, or toy guns. In his last few hours as president, Donald Trump will fly to his private Mar-a-Lago resort and residence in Palm Beach, Florida, aboard the Air Force One jumbo jet for the last time in a presidential capacity. Ensuring he and his wife Melania are almost 1,000 miles away from the White House and Capitol when Joe Biden takes over. Air Force One will then be at the disposal of Biden. Trump would have had to have permission from the Democrat who defeated him in the election to use it if he had waited to leave Washington until Biden was sworn in at noon on Wednesday. According to some reports, a 21-gun salute has been under consideration for the event at the Andrews Air Force Base, and officials are considering an elaborate ceremony that would have the feel of a state visit. Senior Pentagon officials reportedly told the security and intelligence news website Defense One that no military farewell was being planned for the commander-in-chief, unlike ceremonies in the past for Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. With the sun barely up at the start of an expected to be chilly Wednesday, a minimal group of staff still left in a rapidly emptying White House will see off Donald Trump as he takes one last walk across the South Lawn to enter Marine One. The presidential helicopter for the short flight to the Andrews Air Force Base just a few miles away. Strict security arrangements in place for the inauguration following the 6th of January violence at the Capitol building have also limited the number of people who can attend the White House departure. 4 years ago, Barack and Michelle Obama hosted Donald and Melania Trump for tea at the White House before traveling to the ceremony to watch Donald Trump inaugurated as the 45th U.S. president. But Trump has made it clear he would become the only president in a century and a half not to attend his successor's inauguration, and only the fourth person in history not to do so, with the plans for his premature departure unprecedented. Vice President Mike Pence is attending Joe Biden's inauguration, but it is not yet known if he will attend Donald Trump's farewell at either the White House or Joint Base Andrews beforehand. Mike Pence traveled to thank troops in California and New York over the weekend as part of a farewell from the Trump-Pence administration, engagements that would have been expected to be carried out by the president. Donald Trump has not been seen in public since he traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border last Tuesday. In recent weeks, he has not visited the U.S. military and has not visited or spoken of healthcare workers overwhelmed at hospitals and vaccination sites as the United States coronavirus death toll approaches 400,000. The Bidens, meanwhile, may be able to see and hear Trump departing aboard Marine One as they are staying close to the White House the night before the inauguration. There is no word on whether Donald Trump will call Joe Biden or leave the traditional letter to his successor upon the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. Reports on Monday afternoon said that the Bidens would be greeted by the White House chief usher on Wednesday, whereas traditionally it will be the departing president and first lady who should be greeting. They also said Melania Trump would become the first modern first lady not to invite her successor for a tour of the private living quarters at the White House. Melania Trump will become the first modern first lady not to invite the woman who will replace her to the White House for a walkthrough of private living quarters on the second and third floors of the White House. Workers have already hung bunting that reads 2021 Biden-Harris inauguration from temporary stands across from the White House's north portico, visible from the third-story residence, according to a CNN report. The cable news network CNN also reported that on the day the White House military office will ensure there are several nuclear footballs available, the heavy briefcase that is always carried near the president with codes to launch nuclear weapons in case of a nuclear attack. One such so-called nuclear football will reportedly travel with Donald Trump to Florida, and his codes will be deactivated by the time Joe Biden is sworn in at noon on Wednesday, when an aide carrying another nuclear football and working codes will then begin to shadow the new president. The invitation for Donald Trump's send-off specifies that face masks must be worn. Late last year, Donald Trump was criticized for hosting a series of indoor and outdoor events at the White House where social distancing rules were not observed and face masks were not worn by attendees, and guidelines were not enforced, leading to several high-profile COVID cases with the gatherings described as super spreader events.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day drill in central Iran. During the massive military exercises, the IRGC targeted and destroyed the Mach enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the large-scale military exercise, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, kicked off on Friday. IRGC units launched a barrage of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, which were followed by operations by offensive bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC's missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. A mixed attack involving a new generation of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and drones was carried out, and all designated targets were destroyed with pinpoint accuracy. The mock strikes were launched with the presence of the chairman of the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said that Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said the country's armed forces will respond with all might in the shortest time if any adversary had malicious intentions toward the Islamic Republic.
Choosing a barrage of long-range missiles against naval targets illustrates that if the enemies of the Islamic Republic have ill intentions against our national interests, maritime trade routes and territory, they will come under missile strike and will be destroyed.
Donald Trump had attempted through his sanctions to withdraw the JCPOA to weaken Iran. This has not happened, and these exercises certainly demonstrate that. He had wanted Iran in a position that any of those countries, the United States, Israel, or Saudi Arabia, could successfully invade and attack and conquer Iran. But by these exercises, military exercises that have recently been held, Iran has demonstrated that these sanctions have failed, that Iran remains a strong, powerful country dedicated to protecting its people, assisting its allies, and will certainly not surrender or give in to or be vulnerable to attack by its enemies.
The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its naval drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparation and military prowess of the country's armed forces. The IRGC military exercise came after Iranian Navy's drills, codenamed Ehtedar-e-Daryayi 99. The two-day drills were held in the Sea of Oman and the Persian Gulf. A week prior to that, Iran held a massive drone maneuver across half of the country. These drills were launched amid heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. in the final days of Donald Trump's presidency. Tensions have been simmering between the two countries in the past couple of months as the U.S. increases military presence in the region.
These exercises, I think, have been very important strategically for Iran in relation to the United States, because they have demonstrated, as I mentioned earlier, that the sanctions have not worked. So it is in the United States government under Joe Biden, it's in the U.S. government's interest to respect Iran, to re-enter the JCPOA, and to deal with Iran as another global citizen, trading with it, allowing trade with other countries, and working with it in a peaceful manner. These exercises have been a show of strength.
Last month, two U.S. B-52 bombers flew over the region. The move marked Washington's third dispatch of nuclear-capable bombers to the region in less than 2 months. The U.S. Navy had earlier announced the arrival of a nuclear-powered submarine in the Persian Gulf. The USS Georgia passed the Strait of Hormuz accompanied by two American warships, making it the first missile-loaded submarine of its kind to enter the region in 8 years. Analysts say these moves can signal Trump's intentions for triggering a conflict with Iran in his final days in office in order to distract attention from a string of failures in the past couple months. Many others say the outgoing U.S. president is simply seeking to complicate his successor's plans in coming back to the negotiating table with Iran over the nuclear deal. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation which could damage his efforts to come back to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. However, Tehran says it will respond to any hostile action with a strong attack and maximum power.
The
as more evidence comes to light as to just who was involved in the protests that saw five people die in the storming of the US Capitol building. It seems that many of those involved were serving or ex-military staff, raising the question as to just how right-wing the US actually leans. So serious is the situation that the Pentagon has launched a probe into extremist views from within the US military complex, as the body finally comes to terms and accepts that racism is rooted deep within the American system. Since the Pentagon has now acknowledged the problem, this raises the question as to whether the activities of those serving in the military and were part of the mob that broke into the Capitol actually broke more than just one law in the process.
Absolutely. In fact, these military officers that have been complicit, and it's not just the military, not just the Department of Defense, but also elected officials such as Senator Hawley, and also the police officers who we have seen on video leading these so-called insurrectionists into the Capitol, supporting them, taking photos with them. These are absolutely illegal and pose a big problem for the ruling class, because these people, these institutions, are the armed wing of the ruling class. They are there to protect the bourgeoisie. They are there to protect these elected officials and their rule of law.
However, the allegations are nothing new, as the US military has long been known to have racist views, as well as openly recruiting members of far-right or white supremacist groups. A report in the Guardian newspaper 6 months ago saw that the US military had already conducted a report into racism, showing that over a third of personnel had witnessed acts of racism in the service, a figure that's risen by some 14% since Trump took office. It also became apparent that many leaders within the white supremacists and far-right groups in the US were either serving or veterans of the US military, hence clearly linking the military-like discipline within such groups to the actual military body within the United States. Yet, as mentioned, this is nothing new, as the US has long displayed such traits. But what is apparent is the alarming and dramatic rise in such incidents, likely sparked by one very obvious catalyst. As Donald Trump finds himself ever more estranged from the grand old party and the presidency of the United States, his 4 years in the White House have left a legacy that no US president would be proud of, in particular when it comes to dealing with the diversity within his own nation. The endorsement of numerous acts of racial violence, discrimination and protest has left Trump leaving the White House having divided his nation. So many of his actions have actively encouraged and incited white supremacist groups to take a stand in the name of the so-called American Constitution. Trump also failed to deal with the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd by white police officers in Minneapolis. Had he done this promptly, it may just have given him another 4 years in the Oval Office. Trump has, in essence, created a divided and apartheid nation, something that incoming Joe Biden will no doubt have to reunite in his first term as president. However, with Trump very much still active in the background, the task is something that Biden must tackle head-on in order to resolve. With Trump having set the conditions to thrive, the question that now remains to be asked is whether Trump's legacy will lead to a civil or race war within the United States, whether he's in office or not.
Well, the empire is in decline, but it is not anywhere near ready to collapse. We might spend decades, we might spend maybe a year, but it will be time before the empire is collapsing and there will be those factions. The only future that the United States has is either a socialist one or a fascist one. And this battle will have to come eventually, but we're not anywhere near it yet. But the divisions are very deep.
Today I am calling on all Americans to...
Donald Trump has undoubtedly been the most controversial president of the United States. He has managed to make sworn enemies and inspire diehard supporters all across a divided America. His term in office is almost over now, but not the mixed feelings and fierce controversy surrounding the outgoing U.S. president. This week, Trump set a new record. He became the first ever American commander-in-chief to be impeached for a second time by the House of Representatives. Trump now faces trial in the Senate for allegedly inciting a group of his extremist supporters to violently attack Congress last week. In the worst possible scenario, he could be barred from ever holding public office again. That would practically mean the end of his political career. Back in 2019, Trump was impeached over his dealings with Ukraine, but finally acquitted by the Senate. This time, things could look a lot different, as a growing number of his fellow Republicans have said openly that the embattled president must be convicted. Trump has never been so isolated. Many members of his inner circle have either abandoned the lame duck president or seem to have distanced themselves from him. The outgoing president has also lost his cherished Twitter account, and many large corporations are boycotting him. Trump could be wiped off the face of U.S. politics, but his legacy will live on as dangerous divisions deepen in American society.
His main legacy for America is that he's the only president in the history, in American history, to have been impeached twice. Through his mismanagement and his ignorance, he allowed the COVID-19 pandemic to ravage this country, to decimate the economy, and he's the worst president in American history.
400,000 small. This is expected to complicate things for Joe Biden from day one in office.
And we're in the middle of the once in several generations economic crisis.
The United States will soon have a new president. Joe Biden will take office in the coming days. His upcoming swearing-in ceremony will, however, be different from any past presidential inauguration, all thanks to Trump. Security concerns intensified over the past week. Federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies are taking extraordinary measures to secure the ceremony in the capital of the nation. Authorities say they have received information indicating the possibility of more violence during the inauguration. The FBI, for instance, says armed protests are being planned all across America. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will be among the forces that will try to secure President-elect Joe Biden's swearing-in ceremony. Security forces say they want to prevent a repeat of last week's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The developments of the past weeks in the U.S. have raised serious questions about the credibility of American democracy. Was Biden democratically elected? Authorities have found no evidence of irregularities. So why does Trump still insist that the November election was stolen? And why do so many millions of Americans still believe what he says? Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections.
That's evidence that the experiment called democracy right now isn't working. The fact that, well, on the one hand, the fact that we expect there to be a orderly transition of government is a good thing. But what we have to go through to ensure that there is an orderly transition of government does not bode well for America.
Biden will probably try to improve the situation, but the divisions in the United States are too deep and cannot be mended overnight.
So tonight, I'd like to talk to you about our way forward.
Many people around the world have highly condemned the brutal actions of the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine, whilst others have simply turned a blind eye to the actions of the regime, as it does not suit their foreign policy requirements. But when the criticism comes from within, surely it's time to take heed. In a piece in the UK Daily, The Guardian, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem director Shirai Elad slammed the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestine as apartheid control, which, coming from Israel's largest human rights group and a Jewish author, is something that has rocked Tel Aviv, who have quickly blunted the comments via its embassy spokesman in London, Ohad Zemet. Elad goes on to claim that the Israeli regime is working solely to advance the supremacy of one group of people, namely the Jews, which is most ironic, as the Jewish people themselves claim to have once been victims to such treatment, yet fail to back Elad's allegations when it's they who are at fault. So bad has the situation become, from the controlling of land and sea borders in Gaza to the endless slicing away of land in the West Bank, that Elad claims there's not a single square inch of territory where the notion of equality can be claimed between Palestinians and Jews, suggesting clear favoritism towards the Jewish people. With Israel about to enter its fourth election in just 2 years, the rights and voices of the people of Palestine are being suppressed, mostly through the calculated engineering of power by the Israeli regime against Palestinians, be it through political rights or pure and simple denial of rights. But it seems that the people of Palestine are not simply standing back and allowing the Israeli regime to quietly push them into a corner, with regular voices and demonstrations still taking place, opposing the so-called deal of the century, opposing the destruction of Palestinian homes, and opposing the Israeli regime's ongoing attempts to steal more and more Palestinian land. In spite of the United Nations outlawing the Israeli regime from continuing to destroy Palestinian lands and occupy more Palestinian land in the process, the Israeli regime has brazenly ignored the law, hence both undermining an international organization such as the UN and the rights of the people of Palestine in the process. In fact, since the start of 2020, the Israeli regime has demolished over 700 Palestinian buildings, ranging from homes, schools, medical centers, and community buildings, under the faux pretext of lacking construction permits, which is ironic, as they were all built on Palestinian land, hence raising the question as to just which Israeli regime permit could they possibly need. On top of the destruction of Palestinian homes and buildings, it's also the lives of the people of Palestine that the Israeli regime feels it so liberally able to take away. In 2020 alone, at least 27 Palestinian civilians were murdered in cold blood by the Israeli regime, 7 were children, proving that the execution of Palestinians is something that the Israeli regime is also getting away with scot-free. So poor and brazen is the behavior of the Israeli regime that now even Jewish settlers are taking things into their own hands, emulating the crimes of their regime by raiding and attacking Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In fact, in 2020 alone, 248 attacks were committed by settlers, all of which have again gone unpunished and unnoticed across the international community. With the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and Arab nations such as Bahrain, the UAE, and Morocco, it seems that the voices of opposition are being deafened by the regime's false diplomacy, meaning that the people and land of Palestine is being wiped out by the Israelis, and equally as bad, being forgotten by their Arab brothers and sisters around the region.
Zakia Al-Bakhit has long been begging the Saudi officials to return what's left of her husband. His belongings, including his books and notebooks, his bank documents, and above all, his body. Zakia says, "I want to bury him in a place that suits him, not like someone whose identity is unknown, or like someone who has committed an ugly crime." The story of Zakia is the tragic story of many other Shia women in Saudi Arabia who have lost their husbands to a sinister system of injustice entrenched deeply in the kingdom against religious minorities. Zakia's husband, Abbas al-Hassan, was beheaded in 2019. He was among the mass execution of 37 prisoners. Riyadh has refused to give at least 33 of the bodies to their families so far. All of these 33 men belonged to the Shia community in Saudi Arabia. They were all convicted on terrorism charges after trials that Amnesty International said relied on confessions extracted through torture.
The Saudi government body snatching policy has been a long-standing policy for its political opponent, meaning that they reserve this punishment for those who are against the monarchy. And it's very important legally that nothing in the legal papers or the court ruling that these bodies shall not be returned to their families. The Saudi government continues to practice this criminal way of stealing bodies of political detainees and political opponents. This is in contradiction of all international laws and of Muslim tradition.
Mujtaba al-Suwayka is just another case executed in April 2019, with his body not returned to his family yet. A teenager who took part in pro-democracy demonstrations back in 2011 and 2012. Mujtaba was tortured by being hung by his hands, beaten on the soles of his feet, and stuffed with cigarettes, according to Al Arabi. His mother says, "We found out that he had been executed from social media. We are insisting on recovering the body because receiving your son's body means to receive your son. This is the least possible right that can be given to a family bereaved by the killing of its son."
You cannot call the Saudi courts a judicial system because they do not operate like a court. It is a kangaroo court that is medieval, it is sectarian, it's apartheid court that does not allow most of the population of Saudi Arabia to be part of it. Meaning, if you are a Shia, you cannot be a judge, you cannot be a prosecutor. If you are black, you cannot be a judge or prosecutor. If you are a woman, you cannot play a role as well. And if you are not from specific regions or specific background, you cannot be. So that excludes the majority of the country's population from taking part in this apartheid court system.
While the kingdom is considering ending the use of the death penalty for drug-related offenses as part of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's disputed reform campaign, Riyadh has no plan to treat political activists and critics humanely. In the words of Ali Adubisi, director of the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, ESOR, the tragedy of Mujtaba al-Suwaykat is repeated so often in Saudi Arabia that it's become the chorus to a gruesome song. Saudi Arabia arrests a child, tortures them, convicts them, kills them, and buries them in a pauper's grave, all for the crime of speaking out against the government. Saudi Arabia has increased its use of the death penalty since King Salman ascended to the throne in 2015. As of April 2020, under King Salman bin Abdulaziz, at least 800 executions were carried out. 184 executions were carried out in 2019, a rise from 149 in 2018. 37 of these political activists killed en masse following lengthy periods of solitary confinement, torture, and grossly unfair trials, according to Reprieve, a London-based human rights group.
There is not a single case where people who are charged with political crimes have been found innocent. In usually courts, you know, you have people who are guilty, people who are not. But in Saudi Arabia, if you are charged by the Saudi government of any political crime, you are always found guilty. There is not one innocent person, because that's how the court in Saudi Arabia works. Anything that the Saudi government charges you with, the Saudi government gets the punishment that they deserve, that they ask for. And that's how it goes in these courts that are not like other courts around the world or around even in around the region, our region. So These are apartheid courts, and they will never give justice.
Maya Faw, director of Reprieve, says executing prisoners without notice and withholding their bodies shows the extent of the cruelty and calculated violence of the Saudi Arabian death penalty regime. From the start of 2016 through the end of 2019, at least 84 Saudi Shia men were executed or killed in raids by Saudi security forces, according to Essor. None of their 84 families has received a body.
The Saudi government is one of the most, maybe the most anti-Shia government in the world, and that's why there is not a single mayor who is Shia in Saudi Arabia, not now, for the past 60 years, and not a single Shia minister, Shia diplomat, Shia judge, you name it, they don't exist, and that is the sectarian policy of the Saudi government, supported by the English government and by the American government. They know it very well, and they support it just like they supported apartheid in South Africa.
Perhaps the most prominent person executed whose body has not been returned to his family is Sheikh Nimr Bahar al-Nimr, a revered Shia cleric. He was a leading figure in protests that erupted in Eastern Province against Al Saud's discrimination against the Shia community.
The current government or the regime held and controlled by Mohammed bin Salman has no interest in changing the Saudi tradition of religious oppression. And the religious oppression or lack of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia is not limited to the Shia. It encompasses everyone, meaning that the Sunni majority, even those who practice Salafi Wahhabi Islam, they are not free to practice what they think. The government enforces its own interpretation. It forces them, their children, to follow its interpretation of Islam. So religious freedom in that country is becoming less, not more.
For a long time, executions have been at the heart of global criticism of Saudi Arabia. But what has been under the radar all along is the kingdom's refusal to turn over the bodies in an act to show utter disrespect to dissidents, to give their families endless pain, and to warn others that it has no tolerance for freedom of expression, especially from minority groups. A world leader in executions, Saudi Arabia has a long way to go, and its young prince's cosmetic exercises would not help the grave situation in the kingdom.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an...
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of...
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Qalb Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
جلیس بودن خدا مقدمه داره. مقدمه‌اش این است که انسان ذاکر خدا باشه، یاد خدا باشه.
Companionship with Allah needs some prerequisites. The main preface to the love of Allah is remembering Him in any moment and anywhere. If we remember Allah, then He will become our major companion in our life, and if we forget Allah, then the Satan will accompany us. Satan is always tempting us towards corruption. Sometimes, especially for clergymen, corruption is shown by Satan in a lawful manner and face. This will spoil all our positive efforts in life. However, on the other side, Allah invites His servants towards remembrance of Him. He asks His believers to remember Him while obeying and worshipping. In answer to their worships, Allah will remember them by giving them sustenance, bounties, comfort, heaven, and ultimate satisfaction. This is how companionship with Allah works. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Qalb Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Qalb Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.